against the grain. The oceans are in turmoil, but most of it's out of sight and therefore out of mind. I'm Sasha Lilly. Environmental sociologist Stefano Longo will talk to me about the multiple threats to the oceans, from overfishing to ocean acidification, and whether the notion of the tragedy of the commons is sufficient to explain the roots of the crisis. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Sparkling blue waves, sandy beaches, we tend to think of the ocean as pristine and ideal. And when we do consider the threats faced by the oceans, we often think of them as too big to fail, so vast that the damage from fishing or pollution would be diluted in their great depths. But the seas are in crisis, and that crisis has immediate and long-term consequences for humans, from the ravages of commercial fishing and fish farming, to habitat loss, the introduction of foreign species, the collapse of coral reefs, and the enormous danger posed by ocean acidification. So how should we understand the damage that the oceans have sustained in the past several centuries? One famous explanation is to be found in the notion of the tragedy of the commons, an idea developed by microbiologist Garrett Hardin. He suggested that commonly held resources, like the ocean, are doomed to overexploitation by their many users, who have no incentive to fish sustainably because they don't individually own it. Three radical scholars who have studied the oceans extensively argue, however, that such an explanation leaves a lot to be desired, not the least of which is the conclusion that privatization is the answer in most cases. Stefano Longo, Rebecca Clausen, and Brett Clark lay out their argument in The Tragedy of the Commodity, Oceans, Fisheries, and Aquaculture. It's published by Rutgers University Press. Today, I'm very pleased to be joined by Stefano Longo, who teaches sociology at North Carolina State University at Raleigh. Stefano, most of us are aware of the serious threats posed by global warming, and at least some of us are aware that the oceans are imperiled. Could you enumerate for us some of the dangers faced by the oceans?
The transformations of marine systems, I think, that are going on are a clear example of the massive scale and scope of human impacts on global ecological systems. So there are numerous consequences of this related to overfishing and other ecosystem impacts associated with climate change and pollution, ocean acidification. But I could talk about a few of these. For example, in relation to overfishing, the UNFAO estimates that 30% of global fisheries are overfished, and another 50% are fully fished, right? So that means the vast majority of the fisheries in the world are either fully fished or overfished. A recent World Wildlife Fund report came out. It was in the media, and it's some coverage over it, and then they had some really startling statistics about populations of marine life. Vertebrate populations declined almost 50% since 1970, and between 1970 and 2012. Fish species that are utilized by humans have seen a 50% reduction in population over that same period. When we look at some specific species like mackerels, tunas, they've seen a 75% decline in their populations in that period. Other scientists have estimated that large predatory fish have seen a 90% decline in their spawning stock biomass, or the number of spawners that are in the ecosystems since pre-industrial levels. Another study talks about the fact that 1 in 4 species of sharks and skates and another species called kimaras that are related are threatened with extinction. And the interesting thing about that is that these are species that have been on the planet for hundreds of millions of years, and in recent periods seen a stark declines. Other studies, and most of these studies that I'm citing come from journals like Science and Nature, some of the top scientific journals, right? And another study suggests that every square mile of the ocean has been affected by human activities. Coral reefs have been under stress. These are major hubs of marine life, where one in four species are associated with coral reefs, and we see the deterioration of these reefs. And in fact, right now there's some discussion about major coral bleaching event that's occurring on a global scale. That's a great concern, which coral bleaching, of course, will have an effect of potentially killing many of these corals. And some scientists estimate that by the end of the century, tropical coral reefs could be gone. And this is, of course, related to, as well, not only pollution and overfishing, but also ocean acidification and climate change. So we can go on and on, but the effects on ocean systems have been quite severe. And one of the things I think is that we can't see it. You know, it's under the ocean, it's in the sea, and it's hard for us sometimes to get our heads around how serious these impacts are in marine systems.
You just mentioned ocean acidification. Can you explain to our listeners what it is and why it's so serious?
Well, I'm not a chemist, but I'll do the best I can. I'm a marine chemist. But ocean acidification is sometimes referred to as the evil twin of climate change. It's related to the same process of CO2 emissions. So when we emit CO2 into the atmosphere, it exchanges the gas at the ocean surface. And in fact, 30 to 50% of the CO2 that we emit ends up in the ocean. We don't necessarily think about that service that the oceans provide for us. And if the oceans weren't uptaking all this CO2, we'd have much more clear consequences from climate change. Anyway, this went in the uptake of CO2 into the ocean. There's a transformation into carbonic acid, which has the effect of acidifying the oceans. Right, so the oceans become more acidic or less basic due to this chemical effect. So this has impacts on species in the ocean, in that specifically we can talk about species that form shells, calcifying species, because the acidification, of course, deteriorates those shells. But more than that, it requires increasing amounts of energy for those species to produce their shells, and this is an issue not only for that mollusks and so those that we eat, but also for the tiny species that are the food sources of most of the zooplankton and plankton species that are food sources for many of the species we eat, like salmon and cod and all that, because those populations are supporting those food webs. So really, there's very little known about what the long-term implications of ocean acidification will be. And as I mentioned, corals, it will have effects on coral reefs, building that coral reef infrastructure. But the long-term effects are unknown because this is a really rare event. Ocean acidity has increased by about 30% in recent times and could increase by about 150% by the middle of the century, and some scientists suggest that this is the fastest rate at any time in the last 20 million years. So the implications of this are hard for us to know, but they can be potentially very serious.
Obviously, maintaining the ecosystems of the ocean is important for many different reasons, but let me just zero in on the human consequences. The consequences for humans of a degraded ocean. Global warming, not mitigating global warming as the oceans get warmer, is one element of that. Acidification, if the shellfish dissolve because of the acidity of the ocean, that has an impact. What are the other direct ways that the degraded ocean is affecting humans?
Of course, oceans, in history have been a central source of food for human populations, right? So, I think this is one of the very clear ways in which humans are interacting with those ecological systems, drawing on them for sources of nutrients and proteins, energy, in order to live. So the that kind of sustenance and subsistence of in parts of the world where humans still rely upon marine species for their basic nutritional needs. But there are other aspects of this as well. Of course, in terms of employment, many people are employed in the fishing industry and related industry. So over worldwide, I think the number is over 600 million people are either employed as fishing people or associated, industries in processing and distribution and such. So there's the people's, livelihoods as well. But also, humans rely on ocean systems in terms of the ecological services that they provide in, numerous ways. The human life on the planet would not exist without the oceans. Oceans are the great regulators of the climate. Rachel Carson talks about this, right? So Rachel Carson was a marine biologist before she wrote Silent Spring. She talked about the significance in her book The Sea Around Us, the significance and the importance and the basis of life that the oceans are for humans. In fact, that all species emerged from those salty water marine environments to inhabit the earth. So we are fundamentally linked to these systems. And the marine conservationist Sylvia Earle argues that if the oceans die, we die. And that might sound like an exaggeration or a hyperbole, but the argument is, and I think it's a fair one, that these are the systems that support life on the planet.
Serious words there. Stefano Longo is my guest. He's co-author of The Tragedy of the Commodity, Oceans, Fisheries, and Aquaculture. That's published by Rutgers, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I wonder if you could give us a sense of how the relationship between humans and the oceans has changed over time. Clearly, it is a very long history, yet something different has happened in the last few centuries. So could you give us a sense of that trajectory?
As I mentioned, humans are fundamentally linked to ocean systems, and we've been relying on these resources since, the dawn of human history. There are numerous research studies that look at the ways in which humans have drawn upon these ecological systems to provide food as a source of nourishment. And this has occurred on a fairly intensive scale, in the sense that, there's archaeological evidence of mounds of shells from mollusks, abalone, that were used as major sources of food throughout for thousands of years. But in recent times, our impacts on these systems have been such that we have really undermined the long-term viability of these systems. So this really wasn't the case on any general level or scale previous to a few hundred years ago, right? A few centuries ago, this all changed. And in fact, really, it's been since the 20th century and the Second World War era where human impacts on these systems has been so severe that the scale, scope, and pace of these processes has affected the very foundations of those ecological systems, and threatening those ecological systems with collapse. This has only occurred very recently, and we argue in the book is related to the transformation in social systems, in systems of production, in the ways in which we go about producing food, in this case, capturing fish in the book. But this has, I think, you know, broader, of course, implications. So these things have changed in recent times with the onset of capitalist production systems, and we discuss that quite a bit in detail in our framework, what we call the tragedy of the commodity.
Right. So, and you, of course, do emphasize that these are not simply changes that are technical, that they are driven by a logic, and that's the logic of capitalism. But I do want to ask you about the ways that the process of fishing has changed, especially in the post-World War II era. Those who are catching fish, number one, who are they, and what are the ways they're going about doing it?
Many times the fishing, modern fishing systems are referred to as industrial-type fishing systems, and it's a fair way of putting it, but I think, of course, we should call them capitalist industrialist systems, not to overemphasize that technological component, right? Because surely the technology has changed, and so in the modern era, we see the use of these massive systems of capture. Three major ways of doing that are long lines, which are basically fishing lines with baited hooks that run for miles, that capture species like tuna and swordfish. Also trawlers. Trawlers are that kind of drag through the ocean. The most known, well-known effect of ocean trawlers are the ways in which they drag along the ocean floor in order to try to capture those species that are that live on the ocean floor and completely disrupt those ecosystems. And it's been likened to a process of clear cutting on forests in terrestrial systems. So very a system of capture which completely destroys every species and of animal and plant life as it drags through and decimating those areas. And of course that capture system has quite a bit of bycatch, which I can talk a little bit about. But
bycatch is tossing out the fish that you don't want.
Right. Then they're not the target species, or the species that lack a market, or species that aren't supposed to be captured because of regulations and need to be thrown back, those kinds of things. And the third type is purseines, which are giant nets that encircle schools of fish and then have this kind of a purse string on the bottom that closes up and then get pulled up onto the capture vessel. And so, you know, in each of these kinds of systems, you know, the tons and tons of fish can be captured in just one haul. The scale of capture is something that is really unique to the last several decades. I talked a little bit about the fact that coastal communities were capturing kind of mollusk species and species that they could access. But one of the things we talk about in the book we examine salmon fishing and tuna fishing in the Mediterranean and salmon fishing in the Pacific Northwest, and we talk about how those systems of capture throughout history were very different and they changed over time. So both of those systems utilized trap systems, which are very different than these modern, large-scale, say, capital-intensive systems of capture. These were systems that were employed by the community in order to meet, you know, sustenance needs and what we would refer to in Marxist terms as use value or human need. These new systems of capture are driven for the desire to expand wealth and profits, and these industrial systems are, in the large scale boats and capture systems, are the are owned and operated by some of the largest corporations on the planet, Mitsubishi being one of them. So the goal and the process of capture has been completely transformed, and the implications and the ecosystem effects have been very, very different over time.
To what degree have these changes been consumer-driven? That's usually the lens through which we are presented changes to the way that certain species are made desirable and then sold in the marketplace. So one can think of the focus on salmon with its, you know, heart benefits, or the demand for shrimp in the United States, or perhaps sushi around the world in Asia and beyond. Is that a useful way to look at it, or is there something that's missing in looking at a sort of consumer-driven, demand-driven model?
So that's a common way to look at it, in that, of course, people are consuming these species, and superficially, it might seem like the most apparent way to address these problems are to look at consumer demands. And in fact, most of the major organizations that are trying to create movements for bettering the ecological conditions in marine systems are targeting consumers and asking them to boycott certain kinds of fish, don't eat bluefin tuna, don't eat farm salmon, those kinds of things, and send a message to the producer that we're not going to eat these things. You know, in the book we see this as problematic in that, first of all, it individualizes the process and suggests that, you know, human desires and human demands are really at the core of how we produce things. Desires are really not centrally the source of driving the organization of production, that these are production decisions made for other reasons that, of course, things have to be sold on a market and people have to buy them. But those tastes and desires and interests are easily manipulated through systems of marketing and such.
Could you give us a few examples of that?
Right. So one of the examples that we look at in the book in terms of tastes and consumer desires and consumer demands is the story of sushi and bluefin tuna. Bluefin tuna was not always a very valuable species on the global market. This is something that's very, very recent in occurring. In fact, in the U.S., the capturing of bluefin tuna in the middle of the 20th century usually meant that it was bycatch or it was a low value species that ended up in pet food processing. So there was not a lot of interest in bluefin tuna. Even in Japan, where it was consumed, it wasn't the star of the sushi world that it became in the late 20th century. This is a very new phenomenon. It had this metamorphosis of this commodity that became one of the most valuable species in the sea. How did this happen? And of course, bluefin tuna is a species that people have consumed, but wasn't seen as in the areas where I did research in the Mediterranean, wasn't seen as fair of the wealthy and the rich and famous, but until the 1980s or so, when this became a luxury food item that was consumed by the global elite, celebrities, celebrity chefs producing these kinds of things, and so. This became what some people refer to as a boutique species and an item that all of a sudden carried a great deal of status. And now, of course, bluefin tuna is regarded as the most high quality of sushi. which is, you know, something that is historically produced in the sense that there's no real objective quality of the species flavor above a different kind of tuna, let's say, or a different species, but it's something that was produced through marketing, through media systems, and through those producers that saw the potential for expanding the production and profits from the sales of bluefin tuna. Another very interesting piece of that is the fact that the fatty belly of the bluefin tuna, which is seen as the best of the best in terms of sushi, wasn't always consumed even in Japan, in the sense that it was regarded as too fatty and oily. Now, it was suggested that that was tossed aside, or that it was fed to animals or cats. Or, but now this is the most valuable and regarded as the highest quality of fish and sushi. So the processes of consumption are often manipulated and driven by various other factors, and the notion that the consumer, the quality of the product and the consumer's desire for this high quality product is really what's driving it, I think, is misdirected. It's a system of production that is geared towards finding avenues for expanding wealth, and whatever process that takes is dependent on what the particular opportunity is. But it's not an objective process of taste and consumer desires. I think that's misdirected. And looking for consumers to change this system, I think, is hugely problematic, in the sense that as a sociologist, we understand in the book that we are immersed in social conditions and in a historical setting, and the efforts to change production processes or these large-scale systems of fish production based on individual actions is highly dubious, in the sense that we would want to think more about social change occurring on an institutional level, in the ways that we produce these various items for consumption, rather than thinking about it from the consumer end. We would think about it in terms of the production end.
Environmental sociologist Stefano Longo is my guest. We'll return with him in a moment. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with one of the authors of the book, The Tragedy of the Commodity, Oceans, Fisheries, and Aquaculture. His name is Stefano Longo, and along with Rebecca Clausen and Brett Clark, he's written this book, published by Rutgers University Press, which you can find a link to on our website, againstthegrain.org. And it focuses on the degradation of the oceans and the driving forces behind it. Stefano, you mentioned institutional change, and I wanted to ask you about how the reigning institutions that manage the oceans, how do they address the question of depletion? One would think that it would be in the long-term interest of corporations and states to not make fisheries collapse worldwide, because ultimately wouldn't that affect profitability? So how are these systems managed today?
Fisheries management generally, right, is the effort to oversee and administer and regulate these marine systems and try to maintain the long-term viability of these systems. And these happen, you know, through the interaction of scientists, marine scientists, fishery scientists, working on research that try to establish the health of, let's say, for lack of a better word, of the fishery, the species, the number that are spawning, and those kinds of things. And together with the political institutions that regulate fishing capture systems. And these range from, you know, of course, you know, on a local level to federal level to the global level. So we have regulations where nations make determinations about the kinds of equipment that can be used in capture, the limiting the number of species that could be caught, or the type of species that could be caught, at what time of year, and those kinds of things at the national level. But we also have these at the global level where what is it called regional fisheries bodies come together and various signatory nations agree to the rules that are set up by these bodies where they do the same kinds of things, where they require that certain species be caught at certain times of year and have quota, or they might have quota systems where only each boat can only capture a certain number of the species that they are seeking, right? But the issue is, of course, that this has been going on for several decades, right? This fisheries management has been central to the effort to maintain fishing systems, but yet we see a decline in fish stocks. We see major problems in fisheries, and we wonder why that is, right? Why? So we have pretty good scientific information about, you know, what is the state of the fishery, what are the possibilities for collapse, what are the conditions which might bring that about, and how do we avoid that? But yet we seem to continually fall into this same kind of behavior of overfishing and problems associated with overexploitation of species. And there are various ways that this has been explained, why this occurs, but if we're thinking about it in terms of the scientific institutions that are informing management. I mean, we see oftentimes it's considered that there's a lack of political will to enforce the regulations, but in fact, it's a lot more complex than that, in the sense that the drive for continued captures is affected deeply by the fact that it's operating within a certain social context, a context in which a social system, a socioeconomic system that is geared towards growth. And you can develop certain regulations that attempt to minimize those kinds of devastating effects on populations, but in the end, that overwhelming force of an expansionary system tends to win the day. In fact, you know, when we actually look at these regulations, they're not really that strong. Usually, they don't usually do enough to address the problems, because, of course, part of these conversations is always what are the effects going to be if we limit captures, or if we limit fishing systems production? What are the effects going to be on development? What are the effects going to be on the economy? So there's always a discussion about this, you know, great balance of the, you know, the benefits to the ecosystem and the benefits to the economy. But in fact, what usually happens is that decisions are made with the interests of economic growth in mind, and the beneficiaries of that are usually you know, these major corporate enterprises that are profiting from these kinds of systems. One of the other main issues here is, of course, the argument that the outcomes of these are a result of the tragedy of the commons.
Right, which is a crucial argument both in explanations of environmental degradation worldwide and also about the oceans. And I wonder if you can just tell us first about the origin of the notion, the tragedy of the commons, which of course is to do with places that are held in common that are not privately owned, an idea that was developed by the microbiologist Garrett Hardin, and why you think that this incredibly influential concept doesn't work.
Yeah, it is likely the most cited theory or explanation of environmental destruction in the environmental social sciences, but also in the popular literature. We see this all the time. It becomes the default explanation, the tragedy of the commons. So I'll just tell a little bit about the background here in terms of Hardin's argument. So Hardin basically argues that he's talking about commonly held property, and in his famous paper that he wrote, The Tragedy of the Commons, in 1968, he's discussing herders that are putting their cattle out to pasture. And he argues that rational herders that are seeking individual gain will see the benefits of damaging the commons, that common land, by adding more grazing animals to the common pasture and socializing the costs, so that each individual herder sees, you know, the benefit of that they gain from that, adding another cow to the pasture, but realizes that they only pay a fraction of the cost when because they're socialized. And he claims that this is inevitable without either private control or a coercive force like a government entity, kind of a top-down government regulation scheme. So I should note that oftentimes when Hardin is invoked, and his theory is invoked, there's a certain spin that's put on a balance in Hardin that, well, he saw either private control or government regulation, right? So privatization or regulations. But in fact, when he was referring to common land and pasture, he saw private property as the primary solution. You can look at some of Hardin's other work, and he's much more clear about this. There's another famous piece that he wrote called Lifeboat Ethics, which is, I think, a really telling piece of work where he goes on about this. He's talking about the tragedy of the commons, and he likens, you know, he uses the metaphor that was common at the time, the spaceship Earth, and the idea that we should be, you know, sharing resources, and he uses this metaphor of a lifeboat to suggest that, well, we only have so much space on the planet, and he was very, very concerned about overpopulation. That was one of his main motivation for his theory, actually. And in this metaphor, he says that the those that are on the boat, there are only, you know, 60 places on the boat, he says, and there are 50 people on the boat, and those 50 people are the rich nations, and then there's all these other, you know, poor nations, developed nations that want to get on the boat. And should we really be sharing? Sharing it will bring about the tragedy of the commons, he suggests, and that under a system of private property, owners recognize their responsibility, he says, and will care for the property and for the natural resources, and if we open this up to everyone, everyone will take advantage of it, and the whole boat will sink, and we'll all die. So we can't, you know, we can't have a system of where there's kind of mutual benefits or altruism doesn't work, and those kinds of things. So his model was fundamentally based on a rational actor, individual who. And he characterizes human nature as being that, basically self-centered and selfish. And therefore, with this basic assumption that humans are self-centered and selfish and will never act in a manner that has social benefits, we must, you know, deal with that in a particular way. And his main approach to that was privatization. I mean, this notion that it was, you know, either privatization or regulation was really put forth in the context. You have to think about when he was writing it. It was in the 1960s, and this is the Cold War era. And so it was privatization, U.S. capitalism, or coerce, oppressive regulation by the government was just state-centered socialism of the Soviet Union. And, of course, those that were reading this were going to say, well, privatization seems like the most reasonable way to do this because we're not going to certainly go down the road of the socialist Soviet Union. His real motivation or his real policy prescription was the privatization of the commons. That is, common lands, lands that were shared by people, needed to be enclosed and privatized and controlled by individuals and used in a manner to advance that individual's economic interests.
So what's the evidence then that he was wrong, that that people wouldn't go and deplete something held in common? Since, you know, if one's looking at the ocean, one might say, well, that's what this looks like. It looks like these different entities, in this case mainly corporations, are going in and taking what they want and aren't concerned about sustaining it because it doesn't belong to them.
Right, and it seems to work, right? And that's why it's gained so much popularity, in the sense that in our current historical setting, where we see individuals as being fundamentally selfish and competitive and seeking our own rational interests, that model seems to work. And that's therein lies the problem, that it's not historically accurate. So since its inception, the tragedy of the commons approach has had a lot of many critics that see this as a simplified model, you know, and this comes largely, it came from the anthropological community anthropologists who were, you know, looking in history and finding that, you know, this wasn't always the case, right? There are many examples of commonly held resources that were not depleted, that they were not overexploited, that there were certain social conventions and social conditions that maintained common property resources, or what Eleanor Ostrom called common pool resources. Eleanor Ostrom being the famous Nobel Prize-winning economist who was one of the critics of the tragedy of the commons model in suggesting that there are institutional factors that do limit people's the ways in which people interact with these ecological systems, and that underlying, you know, selfishness is not really the accurate depiction of what individual that's interacting with ecological systems, that model is flawed in that it's ahistorical. It lacks that historical specificity. So in our work, we talk about this, right? In the book, we talk about how the salmon capture systems and bluefin tuna capture systems have endured for many centuries, even millennia, right? And these were what you can call commons. You could say they were common pool resources or commons, or common property, however you want to put it. But we didn't see a tragedy of the commons. We didn't see a tragedy of the commons until very recently, until Hardin's time, until after the Second World War era, where this became very common. So why was that the case? Something changed historically. It wasn't that people have always acted in this way in their interactions with ecological systems. It's that social systems have changed over time and have affected the ways individuals interact with them.
Wouldn't a Hardin say, drawing on his other big concern, well, it's population then. What has changed is that there are more people who are wanting to draw from these, hence that is the crucial factor.
And you know, population is definitely a factor in you know, the use of ecological resources. I mean, people use consume things and eat things and draw on ecological systems. So it's one factor, it's true, and human ecologists have looked at this through time and said, you know, there is a relationship between population growth and ecological impacts. But the problem is that to create a model where that singularly is the driver of ecological change, that again is flawed in the sense that there are multiple components that are affecting the ways in which we interact with ecological systems. And certainly more people means that we might eat more fish, right? But when we also look at other trends, though, where, for example, with fish, the per capita consumption of fish has been increasing steadily. And this is particularly true in the global north, right? So we eat more and more fish per capita, and we are, so the growth of fishing, the increases in captures are not directly parallel to the increases in population. Some people eat a lot more fish than other people, these kinds of variations are one of the indications that this is not a process that's directly driven by population. We eat certain kinds of fish and not other kinds of fish that has serious implications. We produce them in particular ways that have certain... So there's production systems and kinds of technologies. There are economic considerations. And to look at this simply as a population issue is flawed, as I said. It doesn't happen as a direct consequence of population. Although, we should be aware that increasing population can affect certain ecological systems. So you might have people, will consume more food if you have, three people rather than one person, but you don't necessarily consume more energy if you have three people than one person to heat your house because you're living in the same house, let's say. So that wouldn't require more energy or wouldn't have more impact on ecosystems, or you wouldn't need to buy necessarily more consumer items unless a system of production is geared towards the individual increasing their consumption and expanding their individual consumption habits, which is tied into our social relations of production. So population is an issue. The short answer is, I guess, there. But it really needs to be understood in that broader socioeconomic context.
My guest is Stefano Longo. He's a co-author of The Tragedy of the Commodity, Oceans, Fisheries, and Aquaculture. That's published by Rutgers. And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. So in the book, you write actually rather beautifully about the way that people have fished in the Mediterranean for bluefin tuna, which you've been discussing in this hour. And that's actually part of your own family history. I wonder if you could tell us about that way of fishing and whether that indicates anything or can point us in some way to a different way of relating to the oceans and to fish and fisheries.
Sure. Yeah, I'm always happy to talk about that. First thing I should note that, we don't suggest in the book that we need to go back to a traditional way of life or to revert to a more pre-industrial setting in order to deal with ecological problems. We're not suggesting that. But what we do say is that these kinds of systems of capture, like the system in the bluefin tuna fishing in the Mediterranean, can teach us a lot about how we can interact with ecological systems in a sustainable manner. The bluefin tuna fishery, as it emerged over 1,000 years ago, has been capturing this species for centuries using trap fishing systems. And these trap fishing systems were, of course, limited by the technological systems and the technological innovation and capacity at the time when they were originally created. But what's interesting about it is that over time, over the many centuries, the system changes very little. So what we have is a passive trap system, which is built at sea. Bluefin tuna that return to the Mediterranean to spawn each year are corralled into these massive traps that are built by these fishing communities. these, as I said, they're passive traps, so they're not, you know, chasing after the species, and they are productive traps. One of the things we should realize is that they were capturing a substantial amount of fish in these systems, sometimes rivaling what they're capturing today, in particular, even with the highest, you know, level of technology, when you have a depleted fishery, when you have the number of species are reduced drastically, even with the greatest technology, you can't really capture that many of them. But these systems were very, you know, very productive. And why were they consistently productive over centuries? Well, we have to look at the kinds of the aspects of the system that allowed for that to occur. And there are some technical aspects, like the size of it, the fact that the nets allowed for smaller fish to escape from the trap, the fact that they were passive and fish had to come into the trap, and they could go out of the trap theoretically or never enter into it at all. Further, because they were so large, the tuna actually could reproduce inside of these systems of capture. So these kinds of technical aspects were important. But it should be noted that the reason why these were developed in the first place was to provide food for people in regionally, right? And there was some export of fish, but usually that was a very regional export. And the central organizational force was to provide sustenance and food or use value and to meet human need. And what has changed over time is that that no longer is the central organizing force of the fishery. Now the central organizing force is how do we expand profits, how do we sell this commodity and extract as much wealth from it as possible.
The Tragedy of the Commodity, Oceans, Fisheries, and Aquaculture, the book we've been discussing today. I've been speaking with one of the authors of that book, Stefano Longo. He is assistant professor of sociology at North Carolina State University, Raleigh. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.